Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Bob Wintermute, and you're listening to the New Books and Military History channel of the New Books Network podcast. Today we're making a sea change, so to speak, as we turn our attention to a recent book on American naval policy and strategy. Institutional reform is a long-established topic for historians of the air and ground forces. Numerous books have been written about the impact of Emory Upton, the root reforms of the early 20th century, the creation of American air power doctrine, but much less has been written about the growing professionalism and institutional transformation of the United States Navy. Save, of course, for those books assessing the role of Alfred Thayer Mahan in creating a raison d'etre for sea power. Today's guest goes far to address this gap. Scott Mobley is a former naval officer who has written Progressives in Navy Blue, Maritime Strategy, American Empire, and the Transformation of U.S. Naval Identity, 1873 to 1898, published by the Naval Institute Press. In the book, Scott addresses many open questions about the Navy's transition from sail and steam wooden vessels to full coal-powered iron pre-dreadnoughts. Most tellingly, though, he goes far to put Mahan in his proper context. That is to say, not as a lonely maverick bookworm, but is one of a growing number of intellectually forward officers who wish to promote the global reach of the United States through naval power. Scott, thanks for joining us at the New Books Network.
Well, Bob, I'm delighted to be here.
What prompted you to pursue this project?
Well, when I retired from the Navy, I enrolled in a PhD program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in history, and this book had its genesis as my PhD dissertation. And it kind of draws together threads of interest that I developed during the PhD studies in cultural history, in the history of strategy in the United States, and also my own experience as a naval officer. In particular, I was interested in where the cultural identity of modern naval officers came from. You know, where did I come from? So I started pulling strings and, threads of strategy and technology, and they landed in the Gilded Age between 1873 and 1898, the years of my book, where we really saw the birth of both the modern Navy and the modern Navy's culture.
You know, I've always found it interesting that the Navy's reform initiatives, which, you note begin in 1873 with the creation of the U.S. Naval Institute, while generally more successful and dramatic than those taking place at the same time in the Army, have really received a lot less attention. You know, it seems like the hypothetical proposals that Emory Upton brought forth, you know, and we should always remember these were all came out posthumously, have been privileged by historians over the very real accomplishments by Rear Admiral Stephen Luce and others. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, you're right. And ironically, the Army really started, it was the genesis of all these, a lot of these ideas. And Upton specifically played a role in tying to the Navy. when Stephen Luce originally conceived of the idea for a Naval War College, he actually bounced it off Upton, and Upton thought it was a good idea. And that was in the late 1870s, but it took another 5 or 6 years before Luce was able to get some traction in the Navy Department and then push forward with the founding of that institution, the Naval War College, which played a pretty pivotal role in this time. And ironically, with that act of establishing the War College, the Navy kind of got a jump on the Army in terms of institutional development in ways that would promote reform. And it wasn't until the root reforms of the early 19th or 20th century that the Army kind of was able to catch up, if you will, to the Navy in terms of institutional development.
Well, I wonder, too, you know, if it's also not possible that Mahan's fame has something to do with this. I mean, is he a magnet for attention, drawing unfairly from other reformers?
Well, he is, especially looking in hindsight. But at the time, Mahan really hadn't established his reputation as a naval historian and a reformer and, you know, and that sort of thing. That didn't really come till gain momentum till the mid-1890s. So there was about 10 years there when he's kind of in a formative stage under the tutelage of Luce. And actually, Luce was a reformer from the get-go. And Mahan was just a naval officer trying to do his job, not too happy about it either. And he didn't get these insights until he actually began to prepare his Naval War College lectures. And then it kind of took off from there. So Mahan was one of dozens of naval intellectuals and visionaries that were in this dialogue at this time in the 1880s and early 1890s. But he was just one name among many at this point. He would emerge later as being kind of a superstar, and that's how we remember him today. But it didn't start out that way.
Right. Well, again, I'm not trying to beat up on Alfred Thayer Mahan or privilege him over much, but he's such a, you know, a titan when you look at the development of the modern United States Navy. And, you know, one of my former guests, Benjamin Armstrong, you know, has given him a great deal of credit for, you know, how he remains a catalyst for naval thought even today. But what I find remarkable about your book is, just as you said, you know, we have to put Mahan in the context as one of a number of very talented naval thinkers who all served together. You know, I think it's very tempting for laypersons and scholars to settle on him as this one personality who defines the institution of their interest. You know, I think that, you know, your book is excellent in that it frames change within the Navy as part of the larger progressive movement in American society, and being therefore larger than just one man. The question then follows, how difficult was it for you cognitively to make that leap? I mean, were you surprised as you followed the course of the Navy during these years, or did you anticipate this?
Well, I think, you know, like everyone else, I grew up knowing Mahan, about his name above all, even more than Luce and others. But I somehow I was able to set that aside when I started my research. And I really didn't know how Mahan was going to plug into the story. I think one of the things that happened is I started in the early 1870s. I actually started in my research in the years right after the Civil War. And other names kind of came to light in that process. And then as I moved forward into the 1880s and 1890s, I already had a pretty good handle on all these other voices. And so when I finally came to Mahan, he enters the story around 1885. There was already a lot of momentum happening in terms of strategic thinking and that sort of thing. And actually in the book, I call it the strategical awakening. And that's really the time from the early 1870s to early 1880s when a number of naval officers began to think about strategy in ways they had not before and began to talk with each other about that in forums like the Naval Institute Proceedings and other publications. and in meetings for the Naval Institute used to have meetings and they would talk about papers and things like that. And so these ideas got out there and they got some the light of day, so to speak. And you can kind of trace the development of the thinking through that time period up until the moment that Mahan enters the picture. But he had the benefit of all this prior discussion as he was doing his own studies and developing his own lectures for the Naval War College. And part of the reason that he did that is because the War College was not well staffed in these days. And there were times when it was just him and one other person might be the permanent faculty of the school. So a lot of this fell on his shoulders. So it was a fortunate, he was the right guy in the right place at the right time, fortunate for him and for us, arguably. But right, he was part of this larger context. I kind of think of it as crowdsourcing, crowdsourcing ideas on strategy in Gilded Age form.
Well, let's turn back to the beginning of the story. Now, you say you started right after the American Civil War. How embarrassingly outclassed was the United States Navy a decade after the Civil War?
Well, a decade after, it was just beginning to feel its pain, I would say. The Navy came out of the Civil War as being, if not the most powerful Navy in the world, it was certainly it was number two after the British. We had almost 700 ships. Many were steam-powered. Many were solely powered by steam, no sail. And it was high-tech. The monitor class of warships was state-of-the-art for those years. So we had the most modern, the largest, most powerful, well-trained, experienced Navy in the world in 1865. By the early 1870s, that Navy had dwindled to a handful of cruisers, about 40 cruisers, give or take some, basically plying the world's waterways to protect and promote U.S. commerce. And therein lies kind of the story of why and how that happened, why the Navy shrank. And it had to do with missions. And it's what the Navy was principally designed for during much of the 19th century.
Well, it's not just a case, I think, of technology, a mission, too. I mean, there's a superannuation crisis within the Navy as well, isn't there?
Right. Well, there's a lot of officers. What happened is that during the war, the Navy expanded, as you would expect, as it mobilized. They brought in a lot more personnel, enlisted and officers. And as the war ended, Congress basically mandated that a lot of these officers, these volunteer officers that had distinguished themselves, should remain on active duty. So that contributed to this glut of junior officers that really took a generation to clear out. So promotions are very slow. There was a joke about how someone could graduate from the Naval Academy, proceed through his career as a lieutenant and be, promote to lieutenant. And then a generation later, he's still standing the watch as a lieutenant alongside his son, who was born, graduated from the Naval Academy, got promoted to lieutenant during his young lifespan. So it was not unusual to go for a couple decades in the lieutenancy, so to speak, until vacancies opened up, because back then it was a promote by seniority system. So you're not going to be promoting until someone ahead of you retires or dies.
Right. Just as in the Army, no room for mavericks, more or less. Coming back to the idea of progressivism writ large, you also make a point that these Navy officers that we see coming in after the Civil War, they're of a different breed than the so-called national progressives who would become interested in crafting responses largely to domestic changes and dislocations in American society. How so?
Obviously, the naval progressives are focusing on naval issues, but they really share the same intellectual roots with the national progressives you're referring to. And by that, I mean small p progressivism. And there's elements that went into that. For example, the use of expertise. And credit, basically you grow these expertise, they get educated, credentialed, networked, and they apply themselves to solving problems. In the case of the national progressives, it's more social problems and political problems. In terms of the Navy, it's strategic problems. and also technological problems. So you have the expertise. You have the second element is use of the scientific method. And I don't mean running experiments. I mean basically critical inquiry, fact-based inquiry. You're trying to gather facts to answer questions and come up with answers. Another element of small P progressivism is a habit of mind that emphasizes perpetual adaption and adjustment as conditions change. In later jargon, we would call that continuous improvement or agile thinking. I think the Undersecretary of the Navy used that word last year. Well, this was intellectual adaptation and agility was a big part of the small P progressivism. And then finally, we had the notion of cooperative problem solving, where groups of officers, kind of goes back to this cloud sourcing idea, where groups of officers would work together to address issues that came up in strategy and technology and other areas, organizational issues and that sort of thing. And finally, there is this ethos of efficiency that kind of permeated this whole process. You know, how can we be more efficient? How can we do the job better? How can we make optimum use of our resources? So that kind of forms this progressive ideology that informed Navy strategic thinkers, Navy technological thinkers at this time, just as it was beginning to inform people that were starting to grapple with social problems. I mean, this is the era where we saw political science, social science was born at the same time. Now, what's interesting about the Navy model of this is that it actually anticipates the wider surge of progressive era development that kind of seized the U.S. In the early 1900s. So it's we're talking 10 to 20 years ahead of that bow wave. So it's kind of ironic because we don't think of military institutions always as being particularly forward thinking, but in this case, they really were. They were anticipating the wider trend in the United States.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, my own earlier work was looking at the Army Medical Department and, you know, its role in creating public health institutions that and systems that would be adopted by the domestic civilian sure. public health world. And, you know, nobody really thinks of that. You know, you present all of this, you know, what I enjoy about this. I mean, we're looking at competing reforms. We're looking at, or not competing reforms, but rather collaborative reforms that are being pursued at the same time, rather than tired, you know, studies or tired metaphors of old guard versus young Turk style change. If we're looking at the paths to reform themselves, what kind of parallels are taking place at the same time? And is there one that would outclass the other?
So within the Navy, you know, you brought up a good point. It's not old guard versus young Turks, really, what's going on. I mean, to a certain extent, you could say, yeah, that was going on in the 1870s. But by the 1880s, there weren't too many old guard people left, and they were not influential. Even some of the more conservative officers, leaders like David Dixon Porter, kind of changed his tune as time went on, and it became evident within the service that something needed to be done to renew and reform the Navy. So he became a bit of a champion of these early reformers like Luce. But so what grew up in the Navy were kind of these two, what I call cultures of progress. And I borrow that term from historians of education and other types of progressive development in the United States at this time. And these two cultures of progress, I call in the book, I call them mechanism and strategy. And really what mechanism is about, it's officers who focused on technological solutions. And to them, the ability to operate, to design, construct, and operate modern technology was seen as the most important priority. So when it came to certain policy decisions like officer education and allocating budget resources, they privileged technology. And then we had this other school of thought led by Luce and Mahan and others that privileged strategy. And that was a more holistic approach. So instead of asking questions about how do we run the ship, or how do we operate these systems on the ship? They're asking questions about what are we going to do with this stuff? You know, we're building, there's this great line that Mahan put out it when I think it was in 1888 Naval War College class. He says, you know, now that we have a fleet coming, a modern fleet coming, because it was under construction at that point, what will we do with it? And that's really the fundamental question. And so these officers kind of had a wider perspective. They valued humanistic education, history, international law, those types of things, as well as the technological side. And they were arguing for an officer corps that could have those types of wider strategic insights, which would translate in practice, would translate into strategic studies, strategic plans, you know, ideas on what we will do with the Navy in fulfilling its mission. And so there was a clash between these two cultures of progress. Interestingly enough, you know, many officers, some officers kind of gravitated to one or the other more or less, but there were many officers that embraced both cultures. And so they got along in general, but when it came to allocating scarce budget resources, they often didn't get along. And that's where we saw this, what I call the culture wars of the 1880s and 1890s, where these were two competing visions for primacy over the Navy's future and over its budget.
Well, yeah, I hear that, and I find it fascinating. And I think back to Brian McAllister Lynn's work, his 2009 book, The Echo of Battle, The Army's Way of War, where, you know, he looks at the Army and identifies three distinct threads of officer culture, you know, guardians, managers, and heroes, as he labels them, that promote change at different times. Now, I don't want to apply his methodology or approach to yours. I mean, I think they're two different works, but I find the parallels really interesting. You know, and he argues that these three groups would exchange institutional prominence over the 20th century. And I think that the point I want to focus on is, do you see a similar interaction between your engineers and your warriors within the Navy?
Absolutely.
Or are they finding a way to share this responsibility?
Absolutely. And in fact, when I was starting out with this project, I read Lynn, and at first I tried to apply his categories to the Navy, but in the end, it just, not surprisingly, it didn't quite fit what I was seeing in the evidence. So that's where I came up with the warrior engineer moniker, if you will, which is a departure. You know, historically, through much of the 19th century, that the Navy, really, its primary mission was commerce, protection, and promotion. In fact, when there was a war, they had to build a whole different Navy because the Navy, the peace Navy, the commerce Navy, was not adequate for just about any kind of national emergency. So you see a pattern through the 19th century, the War of 1812, the war with Mexico, and especially the Civil War, where they kind of, the peace Navy was completely eclipsed by a much larger, more powerful force designed just to fight that war. After the war, they disband that larger war Navy, and we revert to this peace Navy, which was largely around 40 cruisers. Initially sail power. When steam power came in the 1840s, they started putting steam engines on them, but steam was auxiliary, and they were still fundamentally, I'd like to look at the Constitution, you know, old Ironsides, wooden ship, smoothbore, broadside cannon, sail power. And in the early 1870s, you could say most of the U.S. fleet was all those things, with the addition of an auxiliary steam engine. So the technology had not changed very much, but that was perfectly fine for a commercial mission. And Lance Buell talks about that in a couple of different works, this Navy for Commerce, and he's right on that. And it's not until that Navy begins to change due to technological advances, due to a changing world situation, that where we see policymakers need to develop a response. It's not until that change that we see the Navy culture begin to change. And the product of that change is what I call the warrior engineer, which is a kind of a hybrid of strategist and engineer. And going forward, after the period of my book, if you look at how the profession develops, it's still this warrior engineer idea, but they flip-flop. Sometimes officers seem like, one generation of officers may seem more like engineer warriors than warrior engineers. And we see this flip-flop a couple times over the next 100 years, similar to what Lynn talks about in his book.
Well, there's another traditional view of American history that places the Navy front and center. In this case, in the nation's drive for imperial possessions, just at the point your book comes to an end. And, you know, as you say, it said, you know, you're a Wisconsin scholar, so I'm not surprised to see William Adam and Walter McKeever, come to the fore here. They set up the idea of this imperial preparation thesis. But you do take issue with that.
I do. There I was following the evidence. And what I saw, I mean, sure, from 1898 on, yes, we have a Navy largely for empire. Although I also would argue that Navy in 1898, immediately following the war with Spain, was ill-prepared for imperial duties. It was not designed for that. And that kind of substantiates a bit my argument that the Navy, the new Navy that was given birth in starting in the mid-1880s, really 1883-ish up until the eve of the, maybe 1895 or a little later, that Navy was not a Navy designed for empire. That was a Navy designed for defense. And I came to that conclusion after scrupulously reviewing the congressional debates of the time. You know, what were the arguments that proponents of the new Navy were using to convince their fellow legislators to vote appropriations for these new ships? And it was a language of national defense and not empire. And these are times that where there was a lot of debate about U.S. as an empire. Should we become one or should we not? A lot of anti-imperial feeling. Now, ironically, if you look at the Cleveland administrations, which were very much anti-imperial, as you recall, you know, Cleveland shut down a number of projects that would have expanded U.S. possessions overseas while he was in office. And, you know, he was anti-imperial, but it was his administration where probably two-thirds or more of these new ships were appropriated and construction began. So it was very much a Cleveland administration Navy. And again, the one thing that everyone could agree upon is defense. That, you know, there was a sense that America was becoming more vulnerable, partly because of technology was shrinking distances and to power, the power centers of Europe in particular, and partly because the U.S. was itself kind of stepping from a role as a regional power in the Western Hemisphere to a world power. And there were aspirations to get out there and become more involved in world affairs, largely driven by commerce at the time, but also political ambitions. And, you know, kind of a more extreme group were the imperialists who thought we should join the race for empire that Europe had been involved in for really centuries. But I think most people didn't like that idea. And it didn't really happen until we kind of got an empire by accident when we fought Spain. So all the evidence showed me, at least, that defense was the one issue that everyone could agree on. And the votes that were needed to sustain this naval renewal, were most of those people were thinking the nation needs to be defended. And keep in mind that prior to the mid-1880s, the Navy had been designed and deployed and organized for this commercial mission, the peace Navy mission, the commerce mission. During the only time we had a war Navy was during war. So this was a pretty big change in the 1880s, where we had a Secretary of the Navy, William Whitney, in the first Cleveland administration, who says we need a real Navy, a war Navy, that can fight these other naval powers. You know, kind of a peer-to-peer type of situation. Unlike now, we're the status quo. Back then, we were the rising power, and we saw that we couldn't do that with a Navy constructed of wood and sail and broadside cannons. So that was a big impetus for this new technology and this new thinking about strategy.
Well, I wonder too, I mean, what effect is there of domestic priorities or domestic considerations behind the building of the new tech, you know, sure. the new steel Navy. You know, I'm thinking, you know, as we're in the Cleveland administration, particularly his second term, you know, the country is thrown into a tremendous economic panic. And there's very little that the federal government could do to relieve it, except perhaps submitting orders for new ship construction. I mean, is that a factor?
I don't know if they really kind of, that's kind of a FDR type of idea that, yeah, we'll build ships and give jobs. I'm not sure if they were thinking that so much. I know that it was pretty ambitious by the early 1890s. Momentum had really, bipartisan momentum had picked up on the new fleet. And when the panic hit in the 1890s, it slowed things down. They made choices to slow down the pace of constructing battleships, for example, because of that. So it kind of had a negative impact in that regard. But I also think it contributed to these feelings of uncertainty and kind of losing the anchor of society that Robert Wiebe talks about. And so, you know, fear kind of entered the national psyche. You know, the fear of the unknown, and so that might have fueled some of the support for a powerful, more powerful Navy, because we didn't know what we're going to be up against going forward. So it's kind of interesting, the parallels to today, actually, in terms of, you know, fear. They did fear at that point, and I think that might have had an impact. But as far as using the Navy as a source of jobs, I outside the legislators that had shipyards in their district, and that was this whole other thing going on at the time where
and those were largely northern districts, yeah. too. We don't have the major, you know, southern shipyards.
Right.
Correct.
So the shipyards were mostly in the northeast at that point. You're right. And so those legislators were always pushing for kind of pork barrel projects. And there was a big movement. This was part of a wider movement to clear out corruption in the government. You know, the shipyards are seen as hotbeds of corruption. And just as they're doing things like civil service reform, we're creating a professional diplomatic corps along with professional Army and Navy. There's legislation being passed to clean up the shipyards and make them less political institutions. But I think that as far as the jobs going to help alleviate economic distress, that was mainly something that people in those districts were focused on. I'm not saying others weren't, but it certainly wasn't at the scale of the New Deal and some of the policies, the shipbuilding policies of FDR in the early 1930s.
Well, you know, just as in the Army, you know, a lot of the focus on change in the Navy has focused on the influence of the line. That is to say, those officers and those associated with the combat edge of the institution. I want to ask about the staff branches, though. I mean, is there a role played by officers serving in the judge advocacy group, in the medical bureau, in logistics and supply, in the creation of this new Navy?
There is a role. Certainly, like Supply Corps hadn't been created. You know, the kind of proto Supply Corps was there. I'm not sure when the Judge Advocate Generalcy was established, but you know, there were other staff, doctors, chaplains, that sort of thing. They're there. They've been there since really the mid 19th century. But the big one that was had the biggest impact was the engineer corps. And by that, we mean propulsion engineers, steam power for ships.
Right.
And in 1840, the Navy established an engineer corps, and then which at first was very small. And during the Civil War, with so many steam power ships and really what was regarded as a pretty big success for the U.S. Navy coming out of that war. And the engineers, their reputation had heightened, their stature had risen within the fleet, and they began to agitate for more privileges because they were treated as second-class citizens. It was the line corps that had the last say, had rank superiority, pay superiority and all that. So these naval officers that were engineers felt that they had contributed so much more and would continue to contribute. So they should have, you know, status equivalent to the line officers. So there was basically a big struggle between those two corps in the 1870s, kind of peaked in the 1870s. By the 1880s, it was dwindling. And then in 1899, there was a decision made to combine the engineer corps and the line, and they all became line officers, which was an interesting moment, which is outside the scope of the book, but there were frictions there and disagreements and hard feelings. But by and large, it was pretty successful. I think it was a pretty successful amalgamation, if you will.
It strikes me as a natural development, considering the extent to which, you know, the line component really is so intertwined and dependent upon the accomplishments of the engineer branch.
Yeah, you're right.
Just to fulfill their mission.
Absolutely. I mean, the ship's not moving. Particularly, you know, what's happening in around 1890 is that we stopped building ships with sails. So now you're entirely dependent to those steam engines to move the ship, you know, in battle and not in battle. So that's a pretty important role. And I think the Line Corps kind of resented a little bit losing that control to a certain extent. But there's this other thing going on, too. And, you know, which is interesting because in some of the literature on this, they seem to mark the moment of line officers becoming engineers is that Amalgamation Act where they combined the Engineer Corps and the Line Corps of 1899. But what I saw, you know, particularly in the 1890s, these line officers were saying things like, hey, we're engineers, you know, and there's some, I have some quotes in the book to talk about that, you know, the line officers, one guy says, I've got like dozens of electric motors that are in my division that I'm responsible for in the ship. I'm as much an engineer as those guys down in the propulsion plant. And they're right. I mean, the ships, these modern steel warships were technologically advanced through and through, and there's no more sails. So everything you're doing, and there's not that much manpower anymore. It's mostly, you know, steam and electricity that's driving your motors and other equipment, your gun training guns and all that. So really, these naval officers have become engineers in many ways, even before the line corps and the line and the engineers are amalgamated. So when that actually happened, it wasn't so much a revolutionary change as an evolutionary change that largely, you know, acknowledged what was happening already in the Navy.
Well, I think it goes without saying, too, that naval intelligence, in this specific case, the Office of Naval Intelligence and, to a larger extent, the Joint Army-Navy Board, both benefited and promoted reform. But yet, you know, there's something of a lag between the ONI's initial mandate and a strategic analysis and planning mission. Why is that?
Well, the original idea behind the ONI was technological, and that ONI was founded in 1882, and just as we're beginning to the process of naval renewal, we're starting to replace those aging wooden cruisers with modern steel, you know, high-tech warships. And so we didn't have that technology present in the U.S. We haven't dealt with it in the United States. So ONI, in part, was an effort to gather information from around the world on best practices and the types of features we would want to include in this new generation of warships. And that's kind of how it got sold to the powers that be. But some of the people involved with NOI, the officers that helped to shape it initially, they were part of this strategical revolution that I mentioned a while back of the 1870s and early 1880s. And they saw a role, you know, once we establish this institution and it's gathering all this information, it doesn't just have to be on technology. We can answer other questions, strategic questions, with the information we gather. And so it kind of became a de facto place of strategic studies and eventually strategic planning. And some of the first known strategic plans, peacetime strategic plans, that the Navy developed were in O&I in 1887-ish, where we can actually see plans that were written out. They're not like strategic plans today, but they're clearly more like strategic concepts, but they were constructed with a particular problem in mind, usually Great Britain. And what happens if we go to war here? What do we need to do? And try to answer those types of questions. So whether by accident or design, O&I becomes a center, kind of the first center for strategic planning in the United States. You know, keep in mind, just like in the past, we had this peace navy, commerce, and, you know, to protect and promote commerce. During war, we would ramp up and create a new war navy. Well, we also didn't think that much about strategy. Well, we didn't think at all about strategy outside of wartime. So, and it was frowned upon for naval officers to kind of pursue that type of intellectual development. It was considered to be a waste of time. So it was literally a just-in-time navy, and with just-in-time strategy, Civil War being a great example. The war breaks out. We create the Lincoln administration creates a strategy board, and they kept it in place for 4 months, kind of hammered out what we call the Anaconda Plan and the blockade that was part of that. And then they disbanded it for the rest of the war. We didn't really have any strategy making body in existence because they didn't think we needed it. But coming out of the Civil War, there were certain naval officers, Luce in particular, that saw what the lack of strategic thinking and planning did for the Navy. The best example of that is the Navy's attempt to capture Charleston throughout the war. It didn't succeed until Sherman took it from the rear. And there was a moment during the war when Luce was commanding officer of a ship that was in the, I think it's the Savannah River that separates Georgia and South Carolina. He was covering Sherman's crossing, the crossing of his army, and they would have conferences. And Sherman said, you know, Luce, you Navy guys have been trying to get into Charleston all this time, and you haven't any luck. Watch me do it in a week without firing a shot. And he did. So Luce, in his memoirs, commented on that, you know, that moment got my attention. And that was the genesis of my interest in strategy that eventually resulted in the establishing of the Naval War College.
Let's take a step back and look at the creation or the point at which the Navy commits itself to its battleship and cruiser Navy, you know, which is, I think, could be fairly set at the launch of the so-called ABCD flotilla. And for our listeners, that refers to the first three armored cruisers and then the dispatch boat Dolphin, which were launched in 1886. Not just with regards to the small flotilla, but the growing Navy at large. At what point is there a consensus over how to use these ships? I mean, were they still intending to use them as individual vessels going abroad, as, you know, almost as physical representations of the flag and as surrogates for the United States? Or was there a different intention taking shape?
Well, when you talk about showing the flag and you know, representing the United States, that's really what I would call a peace Navy mission. And in fact, the first generation of steel warships, the ABCD squadron, those were basically peace Navy warships that adapted new technology. And in fact, if you take a picture, if you look at a picture of the Boston or the
Atlanta, the Boston, Chicago.
If you take a look at those ships alongside the Trenton, which was built 10 years earlier, Trenton being wood, broadside, sail with some steam power, they look very similar. I mean, technologically, there's obviously the ABCD ships are made out of steel. The weaponry is more modern. It's more casemated. It's not so much as a broadside, but they still are sail powered. They got full sail rigs. Their steam engines weren't all that powerful, so it's more of an update of the peace Navy technology. And the vision for them was pretty much that protection and promotion of commerce. And it's not until a few years later, in that first Cleveland administration, when I think the political leadership begins to understand or begins to perceive a real vulnerability for the United States as we begin to enter a peer-to-peer competition in the world, as technology shrinks the distances between us and the seats of maritime power in the world. That's the moment where the Navy or the political leadership says, wow, we need to have, you know, forget this peace Navy stuff. We need to have a Navy that's designed for war, designed to take on, peer naval forces, not, small local insurgencies, that are out there, or piracy and that sort of thing. This is a war fighting fleet. So we see a shift in mission in the mid 1880s. And this is that Navy for defense I was talking about earlier. We need a Navy that will right. defend our shores and defend our hemisphere. And because these commercial or commerce protecting cruisers don't do that. So that's the next step. We go from this update of older technology for the commercial mission to an actual, new ships, new technology designed to fight other navies. And then it's in the early, around 1889, 1890, when we have a shift of administrations again, where we see the Republicans coming back in. And that's where the battleships, this idea of a battleship Navy really takes hold. But at that moment, remember, Mahan has written his book and it's starting to get, his ideas are starting to get out there, not just within the Navy, but within the policy, the political leadership as well. And not too many people, but there's enough people in high places that kind of grasp what he's saying, that they begin to build a Navy that's more in the image of what he had envisioned. So we have that three-step process ending up, and it takes about a decade, ends up with the battleship Navy. But that's still a Navy primarily for defense. Yes, there were people who thought we could use the Navy to, capture colonies, but they were a minority. They themselves didn't have enough votes to be able to vote for the appropriations for these ships. So it was a defensive Navy, not an imperial Navy, not yet. That came later.
Right. Well, we're talking about civilian oversight and, the impact that the Congress and the Secretary of the Navy has on modernization. Are there examples of where they obstructed modernization or they obstructed change, perhaps to the detriment
right.
of readiness?
Well, there are. There's kind of two categories here. One is due to the uncertainty of where the Navy should go, what kind of technologies should we develop, what kind of organization, what kind of education should we embrace for this new Navy. There were disagreements on almost all levels over which way to go. And a lot of it fell down along this, what I call the mechanism versus strategy lines those were the cultures within the Navy that were competing. Each group had its own political allies, and there was a back and forth going on as they would vie for supremacy over the Navy's future. So we've got that going on, and that hindered progress because debate and things like that. It's kind of the normal American political process. Nothing happens fast. So that was one respect. And then there was another group, the second group, which really it was a minority, but they didn't see any point in having a Navy at all. I mean, they pretty much embraced the historic position of, all we need is a small Navy, a low-tech Navy for our commerce. And if we ever have a war, we can build another Navy. So, this Navy that started to emerge in the 1880s and 90s was not cheap. And they just felt that money could be spent more wisely elsewhere, not on building this Navy. And so sometimes they were able to get enough support that they made certain bills, maybe not the general trend of building ships, but not as many ships and maybe not as quickly as the advocates would have liked because of this type of resistance. And, the U.S. political process is very complex. And basically there's as many representatives of you in Congress you have different interests there. And so, sometimes politics makes strange bedfellows. So you might have people, and a lot of this was just outright partisan politics. I mean, I've seen that where somebody proposes something and it gets voted down, like when the Democrats have a majority in Congress, and then all of a sudden the Democrats there's a new administration, for example, proposes the same thing, the Democrats all vote for it. And so a lot of it's just pure and simple partisan politics, but relations with various constituencies in your home districts. There's the pork barrel thing, corruption to a certain extent as well. I mean, it's all that stuff kind of mixes together into this milieu of political decision making. And it just so happens that they got enough critical mass for various reasons, largely because of defense concerns, I argue, that they were able to keep building this fleet pretty steadily from 1884 on.
Well, this all comes to a head in 1898 with the Spanish-American War. And I think the question then is, how do these various threads come together at this particular moment in time? It's not just a case of, the foresight of the naval establishment has a fleet ready or squadrons on hand ready to wage war against a European power. It's not a case of playing catch up. But at the same time, there is this kind of fortuitous nature here. To what extent does this strategic-minded culture reinforced with technology and a professional ethos, I think it's first and foremost the issue of operation and process, come together just in time? Or was it all already there?
Well, no, it is interesting that it, like you say, comes together just in time. For one thing, by 1898, we'd had about 15 years of creating this new fleet. It wasn't a very big fleet. We didn't have, it was mostly cruisers, both armored and unarmored cruisers, with a handful of battleships. It was not a big navy by European standards. But, and again, it was a navy designed for defense in most respects. Although that was starting to change after 1895 a little bit. But it was a navy for defense. Just so happened that same navy could prove useful against a weak European power like Spain. And when I would teach this to my students, naval history class, I would say that, if there was one maritime power that we could take on and have a pretty good chance of defeating in 1898, it was Spain. And we had the perfect, spark in Cuba. So these circumstances kind of came together. And that's not to say there weren't people in the Navy and outside the Navy that envisioned this, that wanted this to happen and pushed to make it happen all the way from the beginning of this period of naval renewal. But they were a minority. But due to world events and other circumstances, they kind of got what they wanted by, it just worked out that way. It didn't have to work out that way, but it just did. So it was not a foregone conclusion. Again, most people saw this new navy as a navy for defense, not for defeating the Spanish Empire. Now, so you've got that going on, the actual technology and, the firepower, if you will, the modern firepower. The other thing we have going on goes back to this development of strategic planning, starting out with the kind of the incipient strategic plans at O&I in the 1880s. With the as the Naval War College became more entrenched and institutionally sank its roots, it took up a process of strategic planning as well, mainly as an educational tool. It was one of these things, we're going to use this to educate our officers and the strategic concepts and planning. And oh, by the way, the end result of this process, back then they did summer classes, so it'd be a summer session. At the end of the session, they produce a plan that we can put on the shelf if we ever need it. And initially, these plans were all directed against Britain, a possible attack by Great Britain against our eastern seaboard. Those were the first set of problems. But by the mid-1890s, we're starting to see kind of the interest widen, and not so much in the classwork, but in the faculty of the Naval War College and others and people who graduate from the Naval War College start to think about Spain as the revolution in Spain gains momentum, the latest revolution in Spain. And they're saying that this could be a flashpoint. So they start to develop plans for for potential flashpoints in the real world. And so Spain was something that was starting, I think, 1894, 1895. We're starting to see various people write plans or develop plans, strategic plans for a war with Spain. And we start to see that getting debated between different groups. So by the eve of war, that process of drafting, debate, the Navy as an institution has really grappled with the problems of a war with Spain, principally in the Caribbean, but also in the Philippines. And so when the war happens, they don't actually take the plan off the shelf and use it, but the concepts are something that the planning board that the president or the secretary of the Navy appoints to kind of manage the war. Some of these people were involved with that planning process leading up to the war. So there's just kind of like we talk about War Plan Arms for World War II. And in this case, there's not a lot that they hadn't thought about, at least in some way, before the war. I mean, I guess there was a lot they hadn't thought of, but there was a lot they had thought about. So the Navy was a bit more prepared strategically to get into that conflict than, say, the Army was. And so, yeah, that came together at that moment as well.
You know, it's all just so long ago. You know, it's almost an apocryphal story in the context of the modern contemporary Navy. How does this story of the progressive Navy provide inspiration for the current day? You know, what lessons should be drawn from by today's naval establishment and officer cadre as we move deeper into the 21st century?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that lately. And, you know, think about the research I did in the book, and I've come up with a couple of, you know, some ideas to consider in answer to your question. You know, part of this was this reform movement wasn't just about technology, and it wasn't just about organization and just about mission. It was about culture. So the mindsets of the officer corps in particular, that's what I study. You know, stuff's going on in the enlisted ranks as well, but I'm looking at the officer corps in this case. You know, they're changing their perspective. They're changing their point of view. They're starting to think about new technologies and new strategies that they had not thought of before. They had not thought about strategy at all. It was not part of the culture of the Peace Navy to think about strategy. Now they're thinking about it. So as we see technology develop and we see the world change, you know, we're entering a period of peer-to-peer competition that we haven't seen in several generations. They were entering a period of peer-to-peer competition as well. And so they really understood that things had to change. And the changes were driven primarily by naval officers themselves. It was a bottom-up phenomena. You know, it wasn't like blue ribbon panels saying we got to do this and that. These were individual officers crowdsourcing together, coming up with ideas. Working closely with the political leadership, which it was interesting because in many cases there were very close relationships between the Navy professionals and the policy makers, both in the legislature and the executive. And part of that was this was due to ties of friendship and family in ways that may not be possible today. We have a much bigger Navy, much bigger country. We don't know everybody the way we did back in those days, but still. And those close relationships made a big difference in reforming and renewing the Navy, and which helped to shape those cultural changes. So there are some lessons there. Another one is that this was a conflicted phenomenon, and that the reform and renewal and the culture change was built on competing visions for the Navy's future, you know, kind of fighting it out in this culture war. So I asked, you know, I'm thinking about what are the visions today? What are the cultures surrounding us? Do they exist? You know, maybe in the end, they probably came up with the best answer. It wasn't just going to be about technology. It wasn't going to be just about strategy. It was this hybrid warrior engineer who's a strategist and an engineer at the same time. And even through all the changes of the 20th century, you know, strategy never went away. Obviously, engineering never went away. But strategy was always there, even whether it was, you know, engineer warrior or warrior engineer, strategist engineer, engineer strategist. It was always there somewhere in Navy culture. So as we go forward, you know, what is this? The questions I would ask is that how are technological and strategic imperatives reshaping naval culture going forward, and actually military culture, not just the Navy, but the armed forces? You know, jointness is a culture shift. What other factors are affecting that? And then the next question is, how do we want it to shift? You know, these naval officers in the Gilded Age drove the shifts, and they're based on ideas they thought the Navy needed to adapt. So, you know, how do we want it to shift? And then the last question, which is kind of answering your question with the question, is how can an understanding of the past help us to shape this future naval, this future military culture? You know, maybe some of these ideas, bottom-up phenomenon, close working between Navy professionals and policymakers, and the idea of conflict between different groups, maybe those are things that can inform today's efforts to deal with today's problems.
Well, let's move on to our final questions. You know, we have two questions that we normally ask of our guests. First, what are you looking forward to as your next
project? Well, I have two projects in mind. One is an idea I'm toying around with right now is, you're familiar with the 21st Century series that B.J. Armstrong edits. He's been on your show here.
Yeah, I know B.J. very well. And, yes, I am familiar with
so,
it.
We've been talking about the idea of a 21st century loose that may or may not come to pass. I recently started a new job out here in Wisconsin, so that's been consuming much of my time the last few months, but it's something that I have on my short list of things I may go after at some point, hopefully sooner than later. So that's one project. And there's another one, looking at William Leahy, who, as you probably know, was our first five-star off military leader, arguably the first, he was the first chairman of the Joint Chiefs, first national security advisor, maybe along with Harry Hopkins to Franklin Roosevelt. So he was a pretty prominent character in the mid-20th century. And I've done some work on him already. I wrote my master's thesis on him. And one of the things I'm interested in is his role in national policy and naval policy, working with FDR during his time as CNO. So we're talking about the late 1930s. And you know, how much did he do to ramp up, you know, to create the fleet that arrived in 1942 and you know, started the fight in the Pacific and in the Atlantic as well. So looking at that relationship and what it teaches us about civil-military relations, some of these things I just mentioned for, you know, going forward based on progressives and Navy Blue, kind of pulling the thread on some of those themes and seeing where they take me.
Well, I look forward to a Leahy book. I mean, he's so often overshadowed by the other personalities around him, both within the Navy and within national politics and the other services. The second question is, what are you reading or watching now that our listeners may want to check out for themselves?
I'm actually reading Learning War by Trent Hone, and I'm enjoying that book. It's actually part of the same Naval Institute series as mine. It came out a month after mine. And in a lot of ways, our works kind of bookend each other. So it's really exciting to be able to go through, you know, and mine his ideas, think about how they connect to what I've been doing. And that's a lot of fun. And I enjoy that. And in terms of watching, well, I've been binge watching The Expanse the last few days, which it's a sci-fi show. I love science fiction. It's particularly well done. And so that's kind of my pastime at the moment.
Well, that's great. Yeah, Scott, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, Bob, thanks for having me on.
And to all of our listeners, on behalf of New Books in Military History, this is Bob Wintermute. Thank you for listening.